Welcome to my podcast, Living with Ovarian Cancer. My name is Diane Evans-Wood and I'm one of many women who are living with ovarian cancer. I want to give women like me a voice to share with you what it's like to live with ovarian cancer. We will cover a whole range of aspects related to diagnosis, treatment, recurrence and, well, just about everything in between. I hope you find our honest, candid, but often humorous conversations not only useful, but also uplifting. So without further ado, settle down and listen to my conversation today. Welcome to episode 21. This is a very special recording to coincide with World Ovarian Cancer Day. So today I have the pleasure of talking to Katie Wilkins, who I got to know through her work last year for World Ovarian Cancer Day. But before I introduce Katie, please could I ask you to subscribe to the show and leave a 5-star rating after you've listened. It really helps the show to become more visible for people to find. So on with the show. So welcome, Katie. Hi.
Hi. Lovely to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. Katie, can you tell me just a little bit about you, who you are, where you live, whether you've got pets or what your hobbies are, if you've got time, because I know you're incredibly busy.
Yeah, so thank you firstly for having me on your podcast today. It's been I know we've been talking about it for a long time, but I'm really delighted to talk to you today, so thank you for the invite. I'm Katie. I'm married to Brian. We've been together for 12 years now, but married for about 5.5. Yeah. I have 4 beautiful nieces and nephews and lots of godchildren, so lots of kids in our lives, and really enjoy playing auntie and being able to hand the children back at the end of the day, but get them excited. Yeah. So yeah, I live in southwest London, and although we were living in Jersey a few years ago, and I'm sure that will come out as part of our conversations. And yeah, I work in banking, but yeah, love meeting new people. And again, that's probably something that will come out. That's a really big part of what I've loved and one of the upsides of this experience. So
Yeah, definitely. We'll touch on that because that's how we met, really, through World Ovarian Cancer Day. And obviously this episode is going out for that day. It's a special episode just going out on that day. So usually I just release one podcast a month, but there'll be 2 that month. So
Yeah, can't wait to talk a bit more about that.
Yeah. Let's go back to the beginning then. You said you were living in Jersey. So I take it that's where you developed symptoms and started to feel that something was wrong. Can you talk me through what happened? What were the symptoms? And when you went to your GP, what happened from there?
Yeah, and I'm actually going to take us back a little bit further, actually.
Okay.
So back to 2003. So I was in my second year of university. So I'm just trying to think, 22 years old, 23. Yeah. And, you know, loving university life, living in a house full of girls, was studying hard, but partying hard as you do. when you're young and at university. And so when I started getting quite bad shooting pains, like debilitating actually, I couldn't figure out what they were. So I have a recollection of going to the doctor a number of different times and saying, I've just got these like really bad shooting pains, but then the pain would subside. So it was almost like a surge of pain where you'd be doubled over, and then it would subside, but the frequency in which those those shooting pains would happen was increasing.
Was it abdominal area?
Abdominal area, yeah. And so I went to the doctor a number of different times, got given, you know, unfortunately, this is a very common story, but, you know, bladder infection, I got given antibiotics for, I got given antibiotics for UTIs, I got, I got told it was period pain. And just kept going back, but it just wasn't, there's something not quite right. You know, I'd put on a bit of weight, but I was at university. I can't pretend that my diet and my alcohol intake were particularly good. So I just
naturally
put it down to that. Mm. And it was, I have a recollection of getting out of the bath one morning. I was just about to, I think I was taking exams at the time, and couldn't get out of the bath. We had a shower that was in the bath, and so you had to kind of step into it. And I remember I couldn't step out the bath. It was so painful, and it was really early in the morning, or at least for university, it felt really early in the morning. None of the house was up, and my girlfriend was in the room next door, and I had to call out to her to say, I can't get out the bath. I need your help. And I just remember being doubled over in pain. And she was like, right, this is, she'd obviously known that I'd been going to the doctor, and she bundled me into the car, and with another housemate, we went to A&E. And that A&E experience was horrendous. I basically got told by the kind of triage nurse to just take some paracetamol, and that it was period pain, and just, you know, they're there, you'll be fine, go away. So that's what happened. And I remember my housemate really getting fired up at the nurse and going, can you not see she's in, you know, extreme pain here. So long story short, went back to the doctor. The doctor was like, no, this isn't right, let's get you an ultrasound scan, and sent me back to A&E, at which point I was then admitted. So they didn't really know what was wrong, but I will be forever grateful, actually, got to the gynae doctor, the gynae consultant, who thought, I need to kind of check this out, whether it's cysts, whether it's something, there's something not right. And they did a scan, and they did a CA125. And it was at that point that they discovered I had ovarian cysts.
Right.
Fast forward a few weeks, I somehow managed to take some exams. I'm not quite sure how. Lots and lots of paracetamol, ibuprofen, etc. And then a few months later, over that summer, I had my first surgery, where they removed two borderline ovarian tumours, but they were borderline. They weren't. They hadn't developed into cancer at that point. Yes. And I was under the care of a gynae team back in my hometown for probably the next 5 years or so. And, you know, great team. I had regular CA125 that had dropped right back down to normal levels. And to be honest, Diane, I just cracked on with life. I just didn't think anything more of it. I was, by that point, I'd graduated university, I'd just moved to London, and, you know, was busy pursuing my career, you know, enjoying life. And so
were you aware of the fact that, I suppose back then not so much was known about this, but actually borderline ovarian tumours can often be a precursor to low-grade serous ovarian cancer. Had anybody made you aware of that?
No.
They just kept a close eye on you.
I'd never even heard of low-grade serous ovarian cancer before I was diagnosed more recently. So the only thing they did say to me at that time was, you know, in time, we probably are going to need to do a hysterectomy. We want to kind of keep an eye, you know, potentially things can come back in the future. But, you know, you're young. We want you to go and live your life, have a family, but have a family soon. And then, you know, we'll revisit this in the future. That pressure I didn't love that. And to be honest, I was like, I'm not going to be dictated to. around, you know, needing to have a family, and you know, that doesn't sit right with me personally. And so but you know, the longer that time went on, the more it sort of just disappeared into the background. So sorry, long story to kind of get to fast forward back in 2020. It was around, if I think, probably January, February time, I started to get those little twingy shooting pains again. Yeah. But they weren't very often, and I could sort of just put them to the back of my mind, which in hindsight is probably a bit foolish, but you know, I was living in Jersey. I had a really busy job, but a job that I absolutely loved. And I didn't, honestly, we were newly married, we'd only been married a few years, and didn't want to give any brain space to to what that could be.
No, I can imagine that. And unless you'd got other symptoms that sort of drew alarm bells, you wouldn't really think too much about it, would you? You'd just bury that bit and think, oh, get on with life, you know.
Exactly.
Too much to do.
And you know, I'm a pretty fit and active person. It wasn't debilitating my life, so it would be like a twinge and just take a paracetamol and move on type thing. Similarly to the time before, the frequency of those shooting pains, and always shooting pains for me in my lower abdomen, the frequency of those started to increase, and I started probably going for a wee a bit more. And I was like, I do need to get this checked out. So I guess, using my experience, I knew to ask for a CA125 for me. I know that doesn't happen with everybody. Their CA125 doesn't always go up. But for me, there was a correlation between my CA125 increasing and something not being right. So I knew to go and ask for that. What I should also mention is, this was just at the time that the pandemic had started. So the whole experience of needing to get a doctor's appointment, having to do it all through masks, and, you know, that was quite interesting. So that was probably April 2020. I went to the doctor in Jersey and said, I need a CA125 and also a pelvic scan. And was very prescriptive with them, actually, because I knew my history, and she was very open to that as well. So I was pushing on an open door, and I feel grateful that that was the situation, and that I didn't have to go through what I went through when I was at university of no one really knowing what it was. Went for that scan and immediately knew when the radiographer was kind of, you know, going over my tummy, had an ultrasound. I could see what she was looking at on the screen and knew that there wasn't something right, and that there was some kind of tumour, whether that was borderline or what, in my tummy. And so kind of the next kind of bit was very fast-tracked. Because Jersey is a very small island, more complicated cases get referred off the island. And so I was really grateful that I could be referred to the Royal Marsden Hospital.
A wonderful hospital, isn't it?
That was kind of how I guess the first part of the story in terms of how I got my original diagnosis. At that point, I didn't know that it would be cancer. I didn't even know what low-grade serous ovarian cancer was. I remember the gynae in Jersey talking to me about cancer, and she got the CNS to come in at the time of having my consultations, and I remember thinking, but I don't have cancer. I had borderline tumors before. They're not great, but that's not cancer. And being really disarmed about that, not really understanding why they were talking to me about cancer, but I didn't feel like that was maybe what I had or all my experience of what I'd had before. So that was
So then when you were referred to the Royal Marsden, was the first thing that they did was it surgery? Did they then do a total hysterectomy and all the rest of what normally happens, or did they do chemo first?
No, so again, because we were in the pandemic, it was all a bit more complicated. So yes. And Jersey was also in lockdown at the time, so it wasn't that we could go backwards and forwards between London and Jersey very easily. So my aspiration was to be able to have some fertility preservation treatment, because the first step that my consultant at the Marsden, Mr. Butler, was recommending was surgery. So but I'm very, very grateful that I had the opportunity, albeit a very, very short window, to do fertility preservation, because they were going to do debulking surgery. So they were essentially going to take out certainly my ovaries, but they didn't know what else was going on. So there was a potential it was going to be a full hysterectomy.
So for the listeners that don't know about fertility preservation, what does that mean? What does that entail, Katie?
So for me, that meant harvesting some eggs. And we actually went one step further to create embryos. So that was a very short period of time, and we had to sort of time it with my cycle, but also the desire to move quickly from my surgery perspective. So I literally had a 2-week period where I was going through essentially what are the first stages of IVF, so all the injections and then egg, you know, monitoring and scanning, and then they harvest your eggs. And that was really challenging. In fact, out of everything, I think that was the most challenging. I was incredibly uncomfortable by this point. So I had quite a big buildup of ascites, and so my stomach was already quite full. And the pain was becoming more and more acute. And then daily injections of hormones into your stomach, which was unbearable. It was awful. And
Katie.
But it was successful. So we successfully harvested 2 eggs. And that's in the context of there's all sorts of tumours going on. So then being able to find them and harvest them, and them being decent quality, was amazing. And 100% of them, albeit only 2, 100% of them fertilised and created good enough embryos for us to freeze and store. So that was amazing. And I know isn't an opportunity that's given to everyone. So yeah, we'll be eternally grateful for that. So yeah, then I really didn't have any time to sort of sit back and recover, because I think it was maybe a week, probably 2 weeks, a week or two later, I was then climbing back up the steps at the Marsden. For anyone that knows the Marsden, there's very infamous steps that you walk up at the front door, and going in for what would be life-changing surgery. Debulking. I hate that term. But
no, it doesn't sound great, does it? But I know what it means. I suppose it best describes what's happening in there and what they're doing.
Exactly.
So they did then a total hysterectomy. Did they take the omentum as well, or under spleen or anything?
They didn't actually do a full hysterectomy in the end. So one of the discussions that we'd had, and Mr. Butler is, I think, really good at this, kind of before any surgery, kind of working with you on what is plan A, B, C, D, and kind of all ends of the spectrum. So at one end of the spectrum, it was you might come out with a stoma and have a complete hysterectomy, you know, and your life would be very, very different. At the most positive end of the spectrum, they were going to just take my ovaries, and you know, everything else would be intact. What actually happened was somewhere in the middle, although a bit more positive than perhaps. So they ended up taking my ovaries, some of the tubes, I think, my omentum. They had to do some resectioning of my bowel, but they kept my uterus. So that was important because we knew that we had these little embryos in the bank, and potentially that still gave me the ability to carry a baby in the future. Yeah. I remember Mr. Butler on one of my follow-up appointments being so proud of the work that he'd done to kind of maintain the blood supply to my uterus and all of this, and so much so that he was like, I've got photos and a video, would you like to see? It's not for me, I'm definitely not medical, but it was a complicated operation. I think I was under for about 8 hours or so. I lost a huge amount of blood as well, and had to have a transfusion afterwards, but you know, on the whole, I came out and I didn't have a stoma, and I managed to maintain my uterus.
And what was your recovery like? Did you get through your recovery okay, or did you have any complications?
I got through it okay, and I have to say, I'm really pleased that I've managed to sort of maintain my fitness.
Yeah.
My, you know, being fit and active beforehand, I think that played a massive role in my recovery.
No doubt. Yeah.
So it was over the summer. I remember summer of 2020, you know, little bits of opening up through the pandemic, but it was a beautiful summer.
It was very hot, wasn't it?
And just, I remember just being completely melting and shuffling. We've got a park at the end of our road, shuffling up to the end of the road to get an ice cream from the ice cream van, and sitting on the bench in the park, watching kind of people walking around. But it wasn't long before I could, you know, at least start walking, and then, you know, step by step building and getting stronger. So by the end of August, I remember we had a big family birthday celebrations for two of my nephews. We took them on the Watercress Line train, and you know, I was well enough to get there. I obviously couldn't pick them up, but you know, was pretty mobile, so that was that was a big milestone to be able to reach.
So from a pathology point of view, then obviously when you went into surgery, they then will have sent off all your tumours for pathology. What did they tell you about your type of cancer and what stage that you were?
Yeah, so it was on when I came out afterwards. So the pathology takes couple of weeks after surgery. And I remember Brian coming in. So remember as well, because we've been through the pandemic, all of my surgery, I was in for a good few days, was there completely alone, couldn't have any visitors. That was really, really hard. But for this follow-up appointment, I remember Mr. Butler said, just make sure you bring Brian along. So, and that was important to me because I think it's really hard to listen in those meetings and take all of the information in. So yeah, he was there. And I remember Mr. Butler didn't actually tell me the words, which I know many people hear, you have cancer. He talked a lot about, I still had a lot of borderline tumour there. Yeah. So talked a lot about that. And then there was some areas like in my omentum, and I think it was part of my bowel, they had found remnants of low-grade serous ovarian cancer. Yeah. And I just remember not really understanding that and being a bit kind of bewildered by it. And then he was recommending that I would be referred to Dr. Susanna Banerjee, who works very closely with Mr. Butler, and having to sort of I was in a head spin. They were talking about whether I would have chemo or not, because chemo didn't necessarily work with low-grade serous ovarian cancer. And the only thing, I know it's a real cliche, but the thing that I was thinking about was, well, am I going to lose my hair? And But I think that's all your brain's capable of in that moment.
Yeah. It's all part of the processing, isn't it? You know, it is just so mind-blowing. Yeah, and it takes time, I think, to come to terms with what's happening.
Yeah.
And accepting that this is how it is now, especially for you being so young, Katie. You know, it's not part of your life plan. You know,
it's
your age,
not.
That is not part of what the plan would be. Not that it's any part of anybody's plan, but at your age, and I guess that's why nobody, right back in the very beginning of your story, nobody was taking it very seriously because of your age. They were not thinking that it could be anything other than period pains,
exactly,
or IBS or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. They just don't consider it to be part of, you know, what happens to a young
no.
woman. And I think, you know, I just remember being like, but I'm meant to be going back to work, which is such a silly thing, isn't it? But because, you know, work at the end of the day can wait when it comes to your health. But yeah, I was just, my mind was quite blown. And I was so glad that I had Brian sat next to me at the time.
Definitely. I think work, you see, it's familiar, isn't it? We just want to get back to our normality, what's familiar to us.
And routine, Brian, a creature of habit. I like routines.
Yeah. And poor Brian, obviously going through all of this with you, so young. How did he cope with it?
He has been amazing. He is my rock through and through, and has had a difficult experience with cancer in his family as well. Mm. So I think it's difficult when you've had a really negative experience to think, how is this going to turn out differently? Yeah. He's actually written a blog, which was published last year, about his experience of supporting me through this time. And it made me so proud, but it made me so sad as well, because I think we massively underestimate, you know, what families and support go through, whether that is waiting for the phone call after you've had surgery. And I've been on the receiving end of that. My mum wasn't very well, and having to wait and listen for the news is just excruciating. But
it's
also
that powerlessness, isn't it, to do
exactly,
anything.
Yeah. Feeling like you have, you know, you've got to put on a brave face. He dealt with things by, you know, keeping our home life, you know, really well organized, really, you know, I didn't have to lift a finger, you know, washing, cooking, all of that. He's amazing.
I think we all need a Brian in our lives, don't we?
Yeah. So, you know, and his, my family were a big support to him and his friends as well. And I think he learned a lot about, you know, showing a bit of vulnerability as well, and saying, maybe I need a bit of help too. So, you know, showing that vulnerability and getting the love back from people.
That's
a really keen runner as well. So I know that played a big part in terms of him being able to go out and have his own time and have his own release. That was important to him.
I'd love to share his blog in the show notes. Do you think he'd mind? Because I think that might be helpful.
I don't think so, no. So I'll send that to you.
And you also wrote blogs as well, Katie, didn't you? You wrote about your experiences.
I have, yeah. So I found it a massively what's the word?
Cathartic. Is that the
cathartic
one?
Cathartic, gosh. I had a brain freeze. So a very cathartic experience. And I hadn't realised how much I'd been through in such a short space of time. I guess just to kind of finish the end of my story in 2020, I did go on to have 6 rounds of chemo. So that started in the September and went through till just before Christmas, the 15th of December. I remember it well. So every 3 weeks, and I had carboplatin and paclitaxel, so carbotaxel, as it's sometimes known. And I did, you know, going back to that point around, am I going to lose my hair? I did wear the cold cap, and I remember being almost like that was the most terrifying thing. I don't know why. It's silly when you look back on some of these things, but
no, it's not silly at all.
The horror stories that you hear, that you heard about it, and I really, really didn't want to look ill. I know that sounds silly, but I'm probably quite a proud person. I just wanted to be able to kind of, you know, I didn't want to look like a cancer patient. No one does, no. I know, but no. That was important to me. Mm. And I didn't want to be defined by that either. I didn't want people's pity. And so what I did, yeah, so I wore the cold cap, which actually worked really well for me. So I did lose some of my hair, but probably about half of it. And so I had enough. It was thin. And I used to have long blonde hair. I know I look quite different now. I have short, dark hair. That helped me. And I also remember I did lose my eyelashes and eyebrows.
Oh no, it's so strange, isn't it?
It is really strange. Yeah. But I had this one moment, and I'll share it because I share it in my blog, but it was quite a big moment, milestone moment, if you like, which we look back, Brian and I look back on now and laugh about. But I remember brushing my teeth one evening, and this was probably towards the end of my treatment. And I remember looking in the mirror and just really hating what I saw. I just didn't look like me. I was so lucky through chemo. On the whole, I felt pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, the couple of days afterwards were pretty rubbish, but throughout the cycle, I remember I was managing to maintain kind of being relatively fit and active, and I felt pretty good. But I looked in the mirror and I just didn't recognize that person. And I remember I sort of put my head backwards to brush my teeth. And this sounds really weird. I had no nose hair up my nose.
No.
Not that I've got a hairy nose massively, but I had nothing. I could just see it up my nose. And that really upset me. It was one of those moments where I just burst into tears, and Brian came upstairs to come to bed and was like, I was literally sobbing my heart out, and he was like, what's wrong? And all I could say was, I've got no nose hair. And it wasn't obviously about the nose hair, but it was just everything up until that point, and it sort of all came out. And we do look
that
back
was the
now,
catalyst, but... wasn't it? That was like the straw that broke the camel's back for you.
And we look back, and it's something we laugh about a lot now. But you know, when I did start to grow my hair started to grow back, and my eyelashes and stuff, and when my nose hair grew back, I was like, it's not something to be that proud of anyway. But
I know what you mean, because it is just so weird when you've got no eyelashes, no eyebrows, and no nose hair. It just is, you don't realize how dry your nose gets either without the nose hair. And also, you know, if your nose runs, there's nothing to stop it
from just
suddenly dripping.
Runny nose.
Yeah.
It was great not having to shave your legs though, and all of that was brilliant. But anyway.
Did you know, when your hair started to grow back, did you get that sort of funny sort of fuzz on your face?
Yes.
It's very peachy.
Really fuzzy face. Yeah. And I remember looking at photos going, oh my gosh, I've got like a beard, especially when it's sunny.
Yeah.
So, but that did all, that sort of fell out a bit as well. So.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Oh, the joys of beauty and being a woman.
So you get through the chemo really well. And once you'd recovered from that, what happened after that? Did they monitor you every 3 months for a while? Yeah. Did they give you any maintenance treatment or anything like that?
No. So I was really lucky that before I started chemo, there was no evidence of disease. So they were pretty confident that they had got everything through surgery. But we agreed that I would do chemo as a, and we called it belts and braces. So to know at that point that I'd done everything possible to kind of avoid a potential recurrence or potentially anything kind of picked up. I know in hindsight, you know, with low-grade serous ovarian cancer, it's not necessarily, you know, chemo isn't necessarily that effective. But for me, it was important to know that I had done everything possible. And so, but yeah, and we did have a discussion about whether bevacizumab?
Yes.
Say the word.
Bevacizumab. Is that the word that people might
Whether that would be something they would introduce sort of in the latter stages of my chemo. And, you know, as I was going through chemo and everything seemed okay, I was having regular kind of blood tests and monitoring my CA125 and things. We agreed that that wasn't needed for me personally. And so we would kind of keep that in the armory, if you like. So if there is, you know, any signs of recurrence in the future, then that's something that definitely we would look at. But for that moment in time, for me, that wasn't something that they that I went ahead with.
No, obviously, I think with no evidence of disease, it just makes sense, doesn't it, to keep everything else up their sleeve, ready for, you know, if it comes back again. Exactly. Which obviously we know that low grade is notorious for doing so, but I'm hoping that it will be quite some time before that ever happens to you, Katie.
I'm hopeful. I mean, I'm holding on to the fact that it was, I think, 17 years before between my you know, borderline experience and then this. So, and you know, the developments in terms of treatment and you know, where things have come even in the last 5 years for low grade serous ovarian cancer, you know, if I can push that out and it be another 10 years, then, you know, that's something that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Hopefully longer, but.
Yeah, I agree. So where are you at now then in terms of your disease? They're obviously going to be still monitoring you. And I think you've recently had more surgery, haven't you? What was that for?
Yeah, so I am, I think it was every 3 months, having CT scans for me and CA125. And then last, sort of the back end of last year, so remember they took most things, but they had left my uterus. And at the back end of last year, I started to get a little bit of spotting when I went to the loo. Not fresh blood, not badly, but given that I was in the surgical menopause, that just, it just was a bit odd. And so literally within a couple of weeks of me, of this happening, I was like, I need to get this checked, this is not right. And I just kind of learned my lessons from last time, just get it checked. And so had a few more scans and some sort of investigative surgery, so just a couple of probes before Christmas. And what they discovered is there was a little bit of ovarian remnant left on the edge of my uterus that was almost falsely creating a little bit of a cycle, which made me a little bit sad, actually, because I thought, oh, that's my body trying to be, you know, trying to get back to normal, whatever normal is. But but clearly, you know, having and the other thing was my estrogen levels had started to increase as well.
Yeah.
So I was still no evidence of disease. They couldn't find anything. But clearly, you know, having a hormone rich and estrogen rich environment, particularly for low grade serous and for my tumor, that's a higher risk environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, wanting to minimize any chance of recurrence, I agreed with Mr. Butler that, you know, the best course of action was to complete the hysterectomy and take my uterus out. So that surgery I had about 3 weeks ago now. I knew that it was inevitable. I knew that at some point in the future that was going to happen. It probably happened a bit sooner than I was hoping for. But, you know, I look at it in the way that it was preventative. It's I now have done everything I can in my gift at the moment to minimize any chance of recurrence. And, you know, I'm okay about that decision.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it, to get through that because it's so final. But I think it's ultimately saving your life and preventative, like you say. So, but it just takes a little bit of doing to come to terms with that. You're doing
It did.
amazingly well, considering, looking at you and you're back at work now and incredibly busy again, only 3 weeks after
Trying to take it easy,
surgery.
but I think you're right. I'd maybe underestimated the emotional impact, and yeah, I think in the days after my surgery, that was definitely something that took me a few days to maybe a bit longer adjust to. And thank you for your support, because you were a big part of that.
Oh no, I was honored to be able to help. I think we do underestimate the loss of, what really is quite sacred to women, our uterine space. And I think that we need that time to grieve. And yeah, I'm just happy that I was able to help.
Thank you. Thank
So
you.
I know that you don't really have a lot of time because you've got to shoot off for another meeting very soon. But I really didn't want you to go without talking about World Ovarian Cancer Day because last year you were so instrumental in what you did with the billboards and everything. And this year it's even bigger with a team of women with you. But tell us more about what's happening with World Ovarian Cancer Day, because it's this year where you're focusing very much on the younger generation, aren't you? Trying to raise awareness.
So yeah, last year, if I just spend a second explaining what happened last year for your listeners. So Jane Ludman, who runs Cure Ovarian Cancer and is based out of New Zealand, is a great friend and, an amazing woman, the work that she does. And
She
she
is, yeah.
had shared on one of the Facebook groups some of the work that she was doing to try and get a campaign live for World Ovarian Cancer Day, and at the time had managed to secure some billboard space in New York's Times Square, which I thought was amazing. And I don't know what came over me actually, but I dropped her a note and said, what if we were to be able to just make this a bit more global, and what if we were to be able to have a bit more of an impact across other cities in the UK, not in the UK, sorry, globally. So I and she was like, great, if you can do something, I'm in, but over to you. So I put a call out on my LinkedIn platform. I have a background in marketing, although I don't do quite so much active marketing at the moment, but I do have a lot of connections in the marketing world. And through the kindness of strangers, within 10 days, we had managed to secure Piccadilly lights in Piccadilly Circus and over 350 billboards across the UK donated to us for free, and to run, expand the campaign on World Ovarian Cancer Day last year. And it was a bit of a whirlwind, to be honest. We also managed to secure some PR in The Independent, and across a number of sort of local radio stations and on some New Zealand TV as well. So it was amazing and a bit of a whirlwind. And afterwards, Jane and I said, like, next year we'll do it, but we'll bring more people together, because in our community, as you well know, Diane, there's some phenomenal women in our community who've got amazing skills and expertise. And so we'll bring those people together and we'll do it a bit sooner. So we'll have a bit more planning time and do it in more than just 10 days. And so that's what we've done this year. We have a group of phenomenal women who are really passionate about this topic and really passionate about raising awareness and ensuring that their stories, like mine, are not in vain. And it's amazing. There's a lot of commonality in our stories, in terms of that point that, no one thinks that they will get ovarian cancer. No one believes your symptoms.
No.
No one associates a young woman with ovarian cancer. And so that's a big part of what we want to try and address through this year's campaign. So we are delighted to have the billboards again.
And truly amazing, because I went to the ones in Southampton.
To the bus stops and and I it looks like we will have some media in Canada, in Australia, not to mention New Zealand, US and UK this year as well. So bigger and better global reach, but also a much more integrated digital campaign, which you know, when we think about younger women, that's the space that we want to be in. So really excited to be able to share that, and hopefully as this is going out, people will be able to see some of that campaign.
Definitely. Oh, what an amazing campaign though.
And the other thing I should share as well is the patient group that I've sort of set up, which I think will also be a part of this. I'm hoping we can get some of those women involved. So one of the sort of, as a slight aside, one of the experiences I had as part of my cancer journey is to meet amazing women like yourself from all walks of life that I just never would have had the experience of meeting before, whether that's in different countries like Jane and Lexi in the US and you know, some of Morgan, etc., or whether that is just, you know, different roles, different jobs, different, you know, that's what I've absolutely loved. And when I was going through my treatment, I signed up to one of the Overcome support groups. So they used to do like a virtual Friday afternoon tea and chat, they called it. And I met some beautiful people there, people who really helped me come out of my shell a little bit and really come to terms with what I was going through. And as part of that, what I was really surprised at is how many women on there were also had a low-grade serous ovarian cancer diagnosis. And considering it was classified as a rare cancer, I was really surprised at how many of us there were on this group. And so one of the things that I wanted to do, I was chatting to my oncologist, Susanna, and we were just talking about, you know, the impact that patient voices and women's voices can have and the role that they play in some of the medical research community. So her job, she's not only an oncologist, but she is the head of gynae research at the Royal Marsden and the Institute of Cancer, and is doing a lot of work on research into low-grade serous ovarian cancer. And so we started just chatting and almost brainstorming, and I said to her, what would happen if, you know, I could get a few women — at the time I was thinking literally a handful of women — and we kind of, you know, shared our experiences and shared our voices with you, how would that work? And so what that has led into is the creation of the UK patient participation group. It's very not very catchy title, of women with low-grade serous ovarian cancer based in the UK. And we've got over 60 women now from all different backgrounds, all different ages, all different treatment pathways, living in different parts of the country, so across England, Ireland, or Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. And yeah, we are working with Susanna to really help her and bring our experiences to her work, and also the work of others. So Professor Charlie Gawley and some of the other researchers. And that has been amazing.
Oh, it is, isn't it? That I just can't tell you how wonderful that is. You know, because I think it will affect change for the future and give women like us such, you know, a different outcome, a better outcome. You know,
so. that's my That's what I want the legacy to be, is to, you know, for all of our experiences to be something that are not in vain, and something that can help, you know, help provide treatments and ultimately cures. I mean, low-grade serous ovarian cancer is quite different from high-grade. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked a bit about recurrence. The likelihood of recurrence is quite high. And so therefore, you know, the number of times that we go through surgery, that we go through treatment, you know, that takes a toll, and takes a toll emotionally, and it takes a toll physically, in perhaps ways that that might not affect women who've got other forms of ovarian cancer, or even other forms of cancer. And so I think, you know, the topics of things like survivorship or palliative care, or, you know, how to live with, you know, low-grade serous ovarian cancer impacts younger women disproportionately. And so, you know, there's a whole range of topics that we've talked about today, things like fertility preservation and going into surgical menopause, you know, much earlier than you normally would naturally. All of those types of topics are things that I think this group of women can help with. So I'm so excited about the opportunities that this presents, and I feel like we're just at the start, but we're gaining momentum really quickly. So if anybody wants to join who lives in the UK, I hope you don't mind me doing a plug.
That's fine. Any information, I can put that in the show notes.
Great.
So any other women, people with low-grade serous ovarian cancer that are interested in joining, who live in the UK, it's UK specific.
Yeah.
And I'll put the link to the group in the show notes. Yeah. I can't tell you, I really don't have the words to convey to you how brilliant you are, Katie. Do you know, I sit here in awe of you. I really am. I'm so honoured that you're on my podcast. Thank you so, so much. I know that you've got to shoot off now because you've got another busy afternoon, another meeting. But thank you so, so much for sharing your story and all the amazing things that you're doing. So I need to get you back on again at some point.
We will chat again.
Things. Yeah. Thank
you. I should also say, Diane, you do a huge amount for this community as well. So thank you,
thank you.
On behalf of everyone, for all the work that you do as well.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you for listening today. To hear future episodes of this podcast, please go ahead and subscribe now. I look forward to sharing more inspiring conversations with women who are living with ovarian cancer. Until next time, take care of yourselves and each other, and enjoy all that life has to offer.